Hey guys, welcome to Entrepreneurs Uncut. Today we have Hugh Grover on the show, and he's the founder of the Digital Sales Community. Growing up in a successful and ambitious environment, Hugh had the early makings of a serial entrepreneur. With the gift of the gab and an incredible ability to build relationships with people, Hugh was destined for a successful career in sales. Having achieved an incredible track record of sales results over the last decade, from Fortune 100 companies to small to medium-sized businesses, Hugh created the Digital Sales Community to help other business owners and sales professionals with the strategies and support network they need to succeed in the area of sales. Hugh's a wonderful storyteller who's at the beginning of his entrepreneurial career and an inspiration for anyone looking to start their own business. So let's get to the show. Hugh Grover, welcome to Entrepreneurs Uncut.
Thanks for having me, Mark. Mate, yeah, it's a little bit strange to be here, but very exciting.
Mate, pleasure to have you on the show. Maybe to kick off our discussion, I always look with all our guests like to kind of turn back time and go back to the early days. Can you give us a bit of a reflection of what it was like growing up in the Grover household?
Oh, God. Here we go. Straight in the deep, and I hadn't even thought about this, but right. You really put us on the spot. I guess growing up in the Grover household, it was an interesting environment. It was my old man was a captain for Qantas and flew predominantly domestic. So dad was for half the week at home, the other half a week away, interstate traveling. Did a little bit of trips to Singapore, parts of Asia. So he was kind of there for half the time. The other half the time, dad was away. Mum was someone and still is, she's a chief executive of a well-known Australian company. Very, very A-type personality, very much a million miles an hour, runs marathons, absolute operator. And my sister was very much, I think she was the only woman ever or girl at that stage. But mum would kill me if I said girl, was on a scholarship for a private school in Melbourne. So right. you have dad who, is a pilot, a captain, very much control based. You have mum who's chief executive of a company. And you have my sister who's on a scholarship. And then you have me who was horrible at school. I think that's even almost an understatement, horrible at school. Really enjoyed having a good time, really enjoyed kind of football, enjoyed rowing. I had a really good group of mates around me at school, a lot of them that was at my wedding 3 years ago. So very much... for whatever reason, I was in the family, kind of like the icebreaker. I was the affable one. I was the person that when you have three people in the family that are A-type personalities, I was very much the one that kind of brought people back down to earth, either in a good thing or a bad thing. And reflecting on it, I think it was probably a good thing, but very much I was the person in the family that kind of got by, had fun. There was never too many expectations on me in terms of what I would achieve, what I would do. And I guess there was also a sense of, for me, kind of not really knowing what I wanted to do. School, I never really kind of got school and the essence of school. For me, I couldn't understand the theory that I was learning and how it translated practically. So for me, I was at school and there was a huge disconnect between what I was actually learning and how I could potentially apply it. Mm. So I was confident from a sporting perspective. I was confident in terms of networking and building out relationships, but I wasn't confident in terms of my ability and my skill set above and beyond that. So I guess that, and as we kind of share my story in terms of now, the one thing that I never had at school in particular, apart from, a very basic sporting prowess, was having the right skills. And so there was always kind of a little bit of a chip on my shoulder going through school and university because I never really knew what I was good at. Mm-hmm. So good family dynamic, as I said, A-type personalities within the household. I was the one that probably brought everyone back down to earth. However, I never really knew what I wanted to do. And it's interesting, as I say that, it wasn't necessarily something that I was searching for. It just meant that whilst I was at school and whilst I was at university, I couldn't necessarily piece together what was after that. I was very, very much living in the moment.
Right. And you did mention sport playing sounds like a big part of your life in your early years. Was that something that you really gravitated to, that you could almost take solace of, that you knew you were great at and you really enjoyed?
100%. Yeah. So
was it AFL that you played?
Yeah. AFL at school and AFL at university. So it was AFL and it was rowing. I think the thing I liked about it was the discipline. The fact that if you pulled the oar in a certain direction, you did it time and time and time and time again in sequence with everyone else. It was just a habit. And once you develop that habit, then suddenly you'd see success in it. And it was very, very basic, the rowing element and also with football. But the methodical nature of it, the fact that I got a physical release from it. And I think when you're not good academic-wise, you need to find something that you're good at. And in saying that, I wasn't necessarily that good at football or rowing either. Like, I was good, but I, like, you know, I didn't go off to play AFL afterwards. I didn't go and row for Australia. But I was someone that really enjoyed it as an outlet.
Yeah, yeah. And did you consider taking those sports more seriously at a young age, or was that never in the periphery?
Yeah, it was interesting. So as a kid growing up, I was fairly good at basketball. And then suddenly I had the ability to get glasses. Get contact lenses from wearing glasses the entire time. And as soon as all of my mates were playing AFL, well, I was gravitating towards hanging out with my mates. So that's what you did. So basketball was one of those things where I could have actually been quite good at and was quite good at. However, suddenly you do what your mates do, or at least I did at that age, which was kind of go and follow them. They played football, so I went and played football. And it was very much about competing and enjoying competing, but I never saw myself doing it necessarily full time or as an actual profession as such.
Mm, got it. And then reflecting back on like the school, the academic part, Was that tough for you growing up? Did you feel like you were kind of falling behind, and did that bother you, or do you just have really high? Did you have really high expectations of yourself at a young age?
I think there would definitely have been really high expectations growing up in a family with high expectations. However, in saying that, I don't think I really understood what I was doing at school. You know, I look at mum and mum's dad, both of them were very entrepreneurial. Mum left school at an early age. Her dad left school at an early age, was a business owner, very successful in his own right. I guess I could never correlate what I was doing and how that would necessarily help others, how that would provide value to others, how that would be of service to others. So I guess I was very driven in terms of providing value to other people. But through the schooling environment, I never knew what that translated to. And it's interesting as we say that now, when I was part of a sporting team, I knew what my role was. Mm. You're a ruck or you're a centre half forward and you are integral part of that team of it being successful. When you're in a boat and you're sitting in the middle of the boat, your success comes down to how well you row in time with everyone else, how well, you put your body on the line in terms of exerting yourself. And so for me, I guess why I gravitated towards sport, and I haven't even thought of this until now, was very much I felt like what I was doing was providing value to someone else other than myself. And when I was at school, the only thing that would happen is if I got a good grade, well, you know, I'd get a gold star and, you know, maybe mum would give me a pat on the back. But that wasn't my driver. I think for me, it was sport was very much about I could provide a skill set and I could help other people achieving their goals whilst achieving my goals and seeing that actually translate in real time.
Makes sense. And if you kind of set the academic part of school aside, then what you may be left with is, you know, the people around you and the relationships you're building. And it sounds like that role that you played with your family, you know, that connector, that relationships-driven person, did you find solace in that in school, in just building relationships and just having that, like you mentioned you liked having fun. Was that you found solace aside from sport?
I think so. I think it was, I think, you know, and it was interesting. At school, I was very, very present. You know, like I was very, very present. I didn't think too much about the future. It was all about having a good time. And that's why I think I could connect with people in a very real sense. Whether it was teachers that, you know, I was getting C minuses from, they would still really like me, or I believe they liked me. Or we had a certain level of connectivity with, because I genuinely just wanted to have a good time, connect with people, and very much live in the moment. It was never about the future, what I was going to achieve in a day's time, 2 days' time, which is also the reason why at school and at university to some degree, I was never successful in terms of what a mark looked like. However, again, if there was a mark in terms of building relationships, connecting with people, understanding people, caring about people, being compassionate about people, then I probably would have got an A++. But unfortunately, there was no school subject that catered for that.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, you mentioned that. The first thing I think of is that should be a subject in itself. Like if you were going to redesign a curriculum for the 21st century, there's some gaping holes what's needed to equip people in life, whether it be entrepreneurialism or what have you. Mm. It's almost crazy that exists.
What subjects would you have in there that people feel like they need to learn to either be just successful in life? Like what subjects would you personally have in the curriculum that they don't have now? Because I'd be curious to know.
Well, number one, I think it hits on exactly what you're talking about. I think relationships and people.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, we're the human race. Our success is intrinsically linked to our ability to get the best out of each other and build 100%. Those relationships. So, I mean, I wouldn't know kind of how to design a course or what should be actually in that course. I'm probably maybe not the best person to ask, but I think something around that, something around communication skills.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, interestingly, we're getting into it. We'll get into it probably later on and unpack it with what you're doing now. I think selling is one of the biggest gaping holes in any education system. It just seems to be on the periphery, and we're going to touch a bit on that later. But I'm sure that, as well as a lot of other practical life skills, budgeting, financing, you know, a bit drier subjects, but preparing people to live in a commercial world and take responsibility for their economic development, I think that's really, really important. But I hear you, and I can resonate back in the early days. I struggled with it too, not understanding how geography was going to necessarily help me if I was already thinking, you know, that wasn't really going to be a player part in my future. In the end, I ended up reconciling the fact that maybe this is just all a game and I'm okay. They want me to play a game. I'll play a game and I'll compete.
Yeah,
and I think that got me through it. Almost, you could argue that I was maybe beaten to the system a bit, but in the end, as we all do, we rebel and do our own thing, and look back on it, and it is what it is, you know.
And it's interesting that you say it's a game. I guess the disconnect for me was not seeing it as a game. You know, I think it's that whole thing of framing. You know, I think that you've touched on that really beautifully. you know, kind of helping people, and even in the economy at the moment and with things that are happening in politics, we're not going to get into it, but framing and giving people understanding of why things are happening. And that's the ability to persuade, that's the ability to sell, that's the ability to move someone closer to your way of thinking. And I guess that's what we're talking about here. Is, you know, at school, I guess I never really understood why the mechanics of what I was learning and that gamification that you talk about. Because I remember something you said to me very early on in the piece when I first met you, you know, it's called the game of life. And it is, and it's how well you play that game of life and what game you choose to play, which determines your success.
Mm, absolutely. And through that journey, did it strike you at any particular moment in time that, hey, I want to maybe follow more of your mother's and you know, your grandfather's entrepreneurial path? Did that strike you at an early age?
Yeah. So I, at school, one of the things that I from year seven onwards was somewhat entrepreneurial. In year seven, I saw the tuck shop was selling cans of Coke, and this is Coca-Cola, by the way. Cans of Coke for,
of course,
yeah, for $2.50, and I was at in Coles one day, and I saw the boxes, 24 carton boxes of Coca-Cola, and for a box they were selling for like $12 or $14 a box. And I thought to myself, hold on a second, like if I end up buying a box of Coke, and everyone at school is drinking Coke all the time, and I sell it for a dollar a can, and I sell, you know, two boxes of Coke, I can make kind of $48 a day. So anyway, I ended up, this guy next to me had a spare locker, and I said, oh, can I, you know, use your spare locker? And he's like, yeah, of course, take the locker. And so anyway, every day from year 7, 8, 9, every day for Monday to Friday, mum and I in the morning, we would go to Safeway. Sorry, the night beforehand, we'd go to Safeway, we'd pick up two boxes of Coke, we'd put them in the fridge so they were chilled. Then we bought ice packs. And then every day, mum would drop me off at school. I would, mum would actually help me go over to the school to my locker, put these boxes of Coke in my locker. And then every day by recess, I had sold, you know, $48 worth of soft drink. So over the course of the week, I was making roughly $250, and this was for year seven, probably halfway through year seven. I was like, hold on a second. Now what I need to do is I need to diversify. I think actually mum said it. Mum's like, Hugh, now you need to diversify your portfolio. and meanwhile, dad, who's a real, you know, dad's, he's a captain. He was a captain. You know, very, very linear in terms of his thinking. Dad was mortified that this was happening because he's like, you know, what happens if the school finds out about this? You know, you're not allowed to sell stuff from school. This is really, really bad. So mum and I actually set up a fridge in a spare part of the house. So dad didn't actually know that we were selling cans of Coke at school to get around it. Like crazy. And then so anyway, I started selling four or five different products, and every day they would sell out. Every day at recess, I would scream at the top of my lungs, hey, Coke selling, you know, like a couple of cans left. And it was almost like a Victoria market style, you know, scenario where suddenly I would be kind of, you know, I'd be like a hawker telling people to buy cans of Coke. There's four cans left, three cans left, two cans left, one can left, there's one can left going, it's now $1.50, who wants it? And so suddenly it got to the point where I was making about $1,000 a week. I thought to myself, hold on a second, like this is great, but all of my recess and half of lunch is spent selling cans of Coke. Like, I don't even know what I'm doing with this money at this stage. Like you know, $4,000 a month is amazing. And then I was like, how do I kind of take this up a level? And mum at the time was general manager of, I don't know if I should say this or not.
Maybe we'll keep it under wraps.
Yeah. But mum was working at a company. And anyway, she ran this part of the business, which was the lobby shop. And they kind of, after they couldn't sell the product after 12 months, they would effectively sell it off for like a basic cost price.
Yeah.
So I was suddenly buying these sound systems, bits of technology, and selling them from my locker room. So I went from selling, like doing $1,000 a week in terms of, you know, whiz, fizz, Coke, soft drinks, all of this Mars bar Snickers to suddenly going and selling sound systems and electronics and CD players and Walkmans and iPods out of the back of my locker. So I haven't actually told this story in a very, very long time. It's actually getting me a little bit nostalgic thinking about how easy it was to make money back then. And so suddenly this is where it began. And then one day, as all good things potentially come to an end, if you're doing them when you shouldn't be doing them at school, this one day Adam Mueller, the head of Year 9, came past my locker, found out what I was doing, called up mum, called up dad, and said, hold on, like this has got to stop. This is too entrepreneurial. You know, we can't dare have someone at school making this much money at, you know, at 14 or 15 years old. We need to cut it off. So that was the end of the entrepreneurial streak. So I guess at that point in time, it's funny that we mention it now, I had a sense that if I needed to turn it on, if I had to provide value, and for me, providing value was doing something for someone else at a discounted price, and providing value, the fact that they were cold, they were right up in front of my locker, they didn't have to line up for a queue to get into the tuck shop line, that was my unique value proposition then. So I always had this thought process that I would do something entrepreneurial. I just never knew how I would get there until a couple of months ago.
An amazing story. And those numbers, you know, would make anyone sit up and take notice, you know, being kind of Year 7, that's nothing to sneeze at. No wonder you look back at your academic career and maybe feel like it wasn't as strong as some other aspects of your life, because you probably had no bloody time to put into study. And I don't blame why, because when you're making that kind of money, it's pretty exciting, pretty thrilling. I'm interested to know, when it all came to an end and, you know, that gentleman rained on your parade, how did that affect you?
I didn't get it. I honestly didn't get it. You know, it kind of validated what dad's way of thinking, which was very much you play the game. Like, and this is coming back to what you said, you play the game within the parameters that you're in. And so for me, it really, I think it gave me a huge disconnect between school and what I wanted to be doing. Because I was like, hold on a second, like, I'm trying to do something here of value. I'm trying to do something here of entrepreneurial. But you're shutting me down. You're stopping me from doing something. You're stopping me from achieving something, which really isn't hurting anyone, isn't apart from making the tuck shop earn less money. I thought to myself, hold on a second, like this doesn't seem fair. And so I think it was my first time, and this is why you are my mentor, Mark, because you are very good at pulling out things and you have been a huge inspiration to me getting this business off the ground. But I think it was the first time that I realized that I didn't want to be part of a system, like, and not as in not a system in terms of the economy, it's a system in terms of family, but in terms of a business system, because I saw so many flaws in it. And this was, as I'll share through the rest of my story, there was a huge disconnect between me at school, trying to provide value in something that I saw a gap in the market for, it being shut down. And then through my story at my first job, at my second job, at my third job, effectively having ideas, having different ways of doing things, but never being heard, never being listened to, never being kind of valued in that sense. Rightly or wrongly, there's no right or wrong with this, but rightly or wrongly. So I think it was the first time I thought to myself, hold on a second, like I actually want to do something of value. At some stage, I will need to do it myself with the right support, of course, like with people like you around and the community that I've created. But I will need to go and do it by myself or with someone else, opposed to working for someone for the rest of my life.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. And I'm keen to know, after school, what was that next chapter for you?
So being not a good student, it actually limits the amount of options you have in terms of going to university.
But you still went?
I still went to university. So so I went to university. I went to a great uni, actually, Bond University up in Queensland. Had a lot of fun, not too much academics. But again, this is where I got to flex my networking, my relationship building. I remember going up to Bond, and after kind of 2 months of being at university, or I think it was 6 weeks, this guy called Craig Russell, who'd been at the university for about a year, really well connected. He said, "Hey, mate, you know, there's something about you. We're running a ticket for the university. I would love you to be on the ticket for social director." And I thought to myself, I've only been at the uni for 6 weeks. I don't fucking know anyone. I'm good at one thing, and it's networking and building relationships. I don't want that to be shat on within 6 weeks of starting the like at a new university. Like, if people are like, "Actually, are you good at building networks? You just run for this thing and you haven't made it." And this is the thing, regardless of your excuses, regardless of the fact you've only been there for 6 weeks, you either win or you lose. And again, that's just the way that these things work. And this guy that I was going up against, he'd been at the university for 2 years, really well known rugby boy in Queensland. Everyone plays rugby, so really well connected. And I think the thing that he thought was, given his tenure, and given the fact that he had been involved in the community, that was enough to get him over the line. So for me, I knew that I did not know many people at university. What I had to do was work probably 2 times hard, 4 times hard, 5 times as hard as him. So leading up to the actual student association, I had my 5 best mates effectively go to every university dorm room and letterbox drop under the doors. So it was like running, you know, some sort of political campaign.
Yeah.
And so I was handing these letterbox under the doors. And then on voting day, so we did this to about 1,200 dorm rooms. We hand these flyers out every Tuesday night, every Thursday night, every Saturday night. We'd go out, we'd talk about the student association, we'd build relationships with people. And then come voting day, opposed to myself just standing at the door handing out a flyer for people to, you know, vote for me or vote for our ticket, I thought it's all about strength in numbers. Which in business, it is exactly that. Also, and a testament to why you've been so successful as well, Mark, is your relationships and strength of relationships. And so I was like, thought to myself, if it just means this guy handing out pamphlets for our ticket, well, then I'm probably going to lose. You know, I'm not well connected enough. So effectively, I had I had 15 people at that stage handing out pamphlets for me, going into the library, "Hey, you need to vote for this ticket. Hey, you need to vote for this ticket." And actually grabbing people from the library, everyone at uni is so malleable, and actually walking them down to the polling booth, because I had a chat with them at Don's Tavern on Thursday afternoon. And so that was their way of being like, "Hey, you know, we had a drink together. My mates, you know, running for the student association." And so long story short, after the voting went through, I ended up becoming social director of the university, I think within the space of 2 months of being there. And so for me, again, it was just another validation that my skill set was around human connection, building relationships, providing value, solving problems in a practical sense, not a theoretical sense, because that was what I was horrible at. Just got through university. I think I failed a number of subjects. I think Mum actually had to come up one. Mum had to come up, I think, my second last semester. They actually kicked me out of university because my attendance was so horrible. My results were so horrible. And Mum came up and said, "Hey, like, there's got to be another way to kind of give you one more chance." And anyway, begging, pleading. I think I cried in the office because I think the reality of what I hadn't applied myself had kicked in. And the fact, seeing how disappointed Mum was at the fact that I hadn't applied myself, and I'd applied myself in other ways, but again, not ways that were measurable in a university sense, really kind of got to me. And so the last two semesters, I pulled in my head. I lived with my godfather, Paul Melville, and for the last two semesters, got the results, passed university, and that was the end of that chapter. So for me, it was school, networking, building relationships, getting an essence of that. At university was the first time where I got to flex those skills and build out those relationships and actually see value, real value, from building those relationships, maintaining those relationships, and providing value to those relationships, and doors opening off the back of it.
Really interesting to hear this and know that you're in this structure, in this system where you would think the marks, the grades are the index to success. Yet what you were doing in the background, I think if anyone been around in business for a while, what you were doing, building relationships, networking, effectively cold calling also. Grabbing people, having a chat, and then walking them through strangers. I mean, you can't teach that kind of stuff. It's almost an irony that you'd have had to be in that office, you know, tearing up, and your mum pleading for an opportunity for you to stay in university. In ways you were ultra successful, just not at the game that they wanted you to play. It's ironic.
100%. 100%. Yeah, 100%. 100%. And even the thought of having mum having to go through that was horrible. And I know Dad, I think, didn't speak to me for 6 months. He was like this stuff. And you know, rightfully so, but I didn't get it. Like I was at university doing commerce degree. I was learning all this shit and I was going, you know what? I still don't get how I'm going to apply it. But I guess, again, subconsciously here, there's probably an element of me going, I don't fit in terms of these structures. And then the next three jobs that I did, there was this underlying friction within every company that I went to. And it was no fault of these businesses that I worked for. It was the fact that I wasn't playing a game that suited my skill set.
Right. And what was that first job opportunity after university?
Yeah. So left university, had a really great time, went back to Melbourne. And I think it was after 6 months or 7 months living at the family house, you know, clearly very successful, you know, living at the family house, 6 months on from university, not a part-time job, nothing. And I think mum and Hillary, I think, ambushed me, as I like to call it, one day. And Hillary was already doing science at Melbourne University, you know, HD average. And here's me, you know, sitting on the couch every day playing, you know, PlayStation, watching, I don't think Netflix was around, but Foxtel, some of that shit, having my mates over, partying all the time, having a great time. And one day Hillary, like, she just, we sat down at dinner and it was premeditated. I have never asked mum or Hillary if it was, but I 100% no, because they were kind of like, yeah, we should sit down and have like a meal together. And the way that it was framed was very much like I was going into like to be performance managed. And so I was in front of Hill and I was in front of mum. I was like, oh, how's your day? And mum's like, kind of a little bit kind of frosty. She's like, yeah, it's been good. How's yours been, Hugh? And I said, oh, it's been good. You know, it took pretty easy today. You know, meanwhile, 6 months in a row, taking it pretty easy. Oh, so what'd you get up to? Oh, you know, played, you know, Call of Duty. You know, I did this and that. I had my mates over. You know, I'm going to go for a couple of beers after this. And then Hillary, like my sister, you'd see fumes coming out of her ears. She's just like, Hugh, when the fuck are you going to get a real job? This is getting so out of hand. Like you, I think she's something to the effect of like, you're becoming a leech to our family. It was like, and you know what? I was like, I had no idea what I was doing. And so mum goes, hey, Hugh, like, I want to give you some direction. Like, it's been 6 months and I kind of said, no. She's like, just let me introduce you to this one guy, Andrew Stade. He runs a really slick recruitment agency, an executive recruitment agency in Melbourne. And he'll kind of point you in the right direction of, you know, what potentially to do or who to speak to. He's very well connected. And so I met with Andrew. Again, the one thing that I had was I had the ability to build relationships, connect. And I was honest with him. I said, hey, mate, I really don't know what I want to do. I'm good at connecting with people. I'm good at problem solving in a practical sense. And I feel like I'm good at building relationships. And his eyes lit up, you know, in his Versace suit. And he just saw someone that was young and hungry. And he said, oh, have you ever thought about recruitment? And I said, I really don't even know what that is. Which is never a good thing to say to the person that you've been interviewed by. He should have told me to piss off then. So anyway, at the end of this, he introduced me to Tracy Kuro, who's an ex-60 Minutes reporter. And he said, hey, we want to offer you, the median age in the company was 40 to 45. He said, we've never had a graduate come through the business beforehand. We would love you to be the first ever graduate to come through, come on board, and be with our business. So I joined SHK. The one thing that mum said to ask is ask about career development. I was told that there'd be a lot of career development. The first day I rocked up, I think I was sat in a cubicle and given a white pages. And the context was you have to call kind of like 100 to 200 business owners a day. And these aren't like just business owners. These are C-suite executives,
right,
general managers, CEOs. And you need to convince them, like, by the way, 21, a little bit arrogant, a little like, you know, slicked back hair, wearing suits. And I have to convince these GMs and CEOs why I should be doing their executive recruitment. So a lot of the time I would pick up the phone, call them, and I was good enough to fumble my way through getting an interview with them or a conversation with them. But as soon as I rocked up and they saw this 21-year-old kid, they would be like, you know, where's Hugh or where's your manager or where's your boss? And so effectively for that 2 years, I worked my absolute ass off. I was, you know, there was a promise of making all of these commissions. And the 2 years, I just got by. I slogged my guts out. I think I called mum every Friday and I just like cried to her. I was like, mum, why did you get me to meet this guy, Andrew? I hate this job. I hate recruitment. This is the worst thing in the world. And mum just kept saying, just get on the CV, get on the CV, get on the CV, get on the CV. So I pushed and struggled and just persevered for 2 years. Again, not knowing why I was necessarily doing it. Knew I didn't have the right skills. Knew I didn't have the right connections at that level, at that stage. And so I slogged my guts out. And after 2 years, I finally said, enough's enough. I'm resigning. And I finished up. And I left SHK. And when I left, again, I had no job prospects in terms of what I wanted to do. I went back into the old Hugh mode, which was for the next 4 months, sitting on the couch, watching Netflix, playing PlayStation, going out with my mates. And so suddenly 4 months goes by and you know, this is clearly, and you know, I'm really successful at this stage. I've flown up to Sydney for a mate's party, and you know, mum, dad, Hillary at this age are like, he's lost the plot. Like, you know, he's not disciplined, he's not structured, he doesn't know what he wants. And at that time, I honestly didn't know what I wanted because the skill set that I had developed at school, which I wasn't necessarily aware of, the skill set that I developed at university, there was nowhere for me to really kind of flex or use that skills I felt like at this stage. Mm. And I didn't fit the corporate hierarchy. I felt controlled, I felt constricted, I felt reduced. And so anyway, I flew up to Sydney for a mate's house party and I met this guy who was really a beautiful house in Bronte. This house, you know, 4 stories, overlooking the water, glass elevator. Like it was just so aspirational. I got there and this one of the guys that was there who's very, very successful in sales. I met with him that night and I was just looking at him and the way he carried himself and the way he connected with people. And I said, hey, mate, like how have you found sales? And he said to me, when I started in sales, it was really, really hard until I learned the right skills. I was like, oh my God. It was like a light bulb moment. I was like, holy shit. Like, no wonder I haven't been good at this recruitment job. Like I've gone in there and I've just done like the networking element of like, building huge amounts of rapport, generally connecting with people, trying to help them. But I didn't have the right skill set. I didn't know how to sell. I didn't know how to persuade. I hadn't learned about human behavior and human psychology. I hadn't learned to really connect with people and understand their problems. And then once I understood their problems, how to help them. So that night in the middle of the party, like it was just like this this just kind of serendipitous moment. I've gone downstairs in this middle of the party. By the way, there's beautiful girls, there's beautiful guys with this amazing house party, cool DJ. And for the first time, I've gone, holy shit, there is probably an answer for me to be successful in a corporate environment, but I need to learn the right skills. So I went downstairs in this room, pulled out my laptop, and for the next 2 hours, I think I searched on Seek over and over and over again for sales roles. And I found this one job in particular for a Fortune 100 company, American Express, and thought to myself, yeah, I'm going to apply for it. So I applied for this job, applied for a whole bunch of other jobs. And then before I know it, I'm back in Melbourne. 2 weeks have passed. I'm back in my routine, which is playing PlayStation, hanging with my mates, going out and partying, not really doing a huge amount. And I remembered feeling that if I connected to a feeling now, I felt worthless at that point in time. I felt like I didn't have a purpose. I'd gone to university. In a sense, I hadn't been able to connect with what my skill set was. I'd gone to school and hadn't connected with what my skill set was and been rewarded for it. I'd gone into recruitment and hadn't been successful. And now I'm thinking, you know, I'm now back lying in bed at the stage watching Netflix or whatever it was, Foxtel. And things aren't going really well. They're not looking like things are going to be successful or I'm going to be anywhere where I want to be, even though I didn't have a plan. And as Mum says to me all the time, if you don't have a plan, any path will get you there. And I was certainly on that trajectory of getting to nowhere. And so I remember distinctively, it's like 2 o'clock on a Thursday, I've got the blinds pulled down in my bedroom. Like, it's a really depressing side. Put this laptop there, watching Netflix. And suddenly the phone rings and it's an 02 number. I was like, it's either a telemarketer or it's someone calling about a job opportunity. And so I hesitantly answered, oh, it's Hugh speaking. And on the other end of the phone, I heard, hey, it's Craig here calling from American Express. How are you going? And I was like, in that moment, I knew that I had to turn it on. I needed to convince them that I needed to get an opportunity to present, to meet with them and to at least have that first round of interview. And if I had that first round of interview, then I was going to do whatever it took to going back to that house party, to learn the right skills, to persuade, to build rapport, to be able to solve people's problems so that I could be successful in sales. So I got off the phone with Craig. I ended up getting the interview. And from that day, every day, almost religiously, I had listened to a sales podcast. I read a sales book. I read a persuasion-based book. I read a human psychology book. I read a book on neuro-linguistic programming, which is the way that the mind works and asking specific questions to get people to think differently. And so from going from recruitment to then going to a Fortune 100 company, within the space of the first 12 months, I think within the team, I was the top performer. Within nationally, I was the second top performer within 12 months. Usually it takes 2 to 3 years to get like a client book and then be successful. Year two, I was the top 1% revenue generator. Year three, top 1% revenue generator. Top three, the following year, top 1% revenue generator. 4 consecutive years, I've been the top 1% revenue generator for a Fortune 100 company. It was the first time that I went, holy shit, like I can do this. I'm solving people's problems. I'm understanding how I can help them and I'm providing them value. However, there was still this underlying feeling. So it was the first time that I had been able to achieve something within a construct that didn't suit me well. And that gave me a sense of
accomplishment.
Accomplishment, 100%, a sense of accomplishment, a sense of I can do this and I am successful. However, there was that disconnect of having ideas, having expressions of what I wanted to do, but never feeling like I could execute them on them. I was purely someone within a company that was a cog in a wheel that made the business a lot of money. But at the end of the day, that's all I was. There was no opportunity for me to kind of help people in anything other than bringing in new clients, servicing those clients really well, providing huge amounts of value to them. But that was it. And so at the end of kind of 4 years, 5 years of being with American Express, my wife had just decided to start a fashion label. And so I was supporting her. And then after about 6 months, 9 months, she was starting to get some traction with it, but it kind of wasn't really taking off to the level that it needed to for us to kind of live, you know, the life that we wanted. We're spending a lot of money investing into it. And so then serendipitously, Marlo introduced me to this guy called Lockie, who worked for a fashion brand up in Sydney. They're based in Sydney, Melbourne, and Adelaide. And suddenly one thing led to another, where there was an opportunity to be a managing partner of a retail business. And for me, I thought to myself, hold on, like, it's entrepreneurial. You know, I'm running a business. I'm able to have autonomy in that business. However, you know, I don't know much about retail. I don't know much about running a business. And so suddenly I was like, if I want Marlo to be successful in her business, I probably need to learn a little bit more about the industry. I need to learn a little bit more about retail, and how I can provide value to her is by learning the ins and outs of the industry. So I went to this retail business as managing partner. And over 6 months, this was a company, by the way, for 2.5 years, had flatlined with revenue. So effectively, if it's flatlined, it's almost going backwards. So everything that they tried bringing on BDMs, they had tried partnerships, they tried everything under the sun. They couldn't turn the dial on revenue. Within 6 months, I had grown the business by 36+%. And this is a million-dollar business, turnover business, had grown it by 36%, I think, in 5 months. And so things are starting to go well. You know, I'm starting to go, holy shit, like, I can transfer my skill set of sales, my ability to network. And then suddenly February of 2020 happened and the pandemic's happening. And suddenly I've gone to myself, holy shit, like, this business doesn't have an e-commerce platform. It is purely a retail business that's bricks and mortar based. And I thought to myself, Marlo was in Bali at the time, partying with her girlfriends, having a great time. And so I called up Mum and said, hey, I think this is going to get really bad, this whole COVID thing. I don't know where this is going to go. And as part of my contract, I have a clause to get out and get a certain payout from the business if I resign within the next week. So I literally called up Mum, had a conversation with her HR partner at her business, and we came to the conclusion that the best course of action was to actually resign. So I have just started to get some runs on the board, or some massive runs on the board for this business. We've grown it by 36% in literally less than 6 months. And I've called up Marlo and Barley, and she's partying with her girlfriends. I can hear them in the background at Potato Head. They're having a great time. I said, hey, darling, I said, let you know, I'm resigning. She goes, why are you resigning? And I was like, I'm resigning because have you heard of this thing called COVID? And she's like, yeah, we heard something on the news, but like, it's no big deal. I said, no. This thing's going to be a fucking disaster. Like, this thing's going to be a disaster. I said, I'm resigning. And she goes, what do you mean you're resigning? Like, we live in Sydney. Like, what are you going to do? I said, hey, I don't know. All I know is I've got this kind of weak window to resign to get this payout. Otherwise, the payout that I'm due, I'm not going to receive. So that afternoon, I've called Marlo in Bali, told her that I'm resigning from this company, which I have just helped grow and started to get some huge traction with. And suddenly Marlo and I pack up all of our stuff from Sydney, this Potts Point apartment, put it back into an 8-ton truck, drive down to Melbourne, and we have no idea what we're doing. So being a Fortune 100 company, got some huge success in a short period of time, gone to a retail brand, grown it by 36%, and now we're driving back to Melbourne, which we never wanted to go back to start again. And so we get back to Melbourne, and I get a call from Anthony Mullane, who's a really great mate of mine, who's at Carb, who you know really well, and the boys there. He said, hey, mate, I've heard about everything that's happened in um, you know, with your business and you're resigning, mate, I'd love you to kind of come on board as a membership director for Cub. Would you be interested? And so for me, I was kind of in two minds. You know, I was one in the mind that I didn't want to be based in Melbourne. However, I wanted to, for me at that stage, being around the right network was so important. And just on this networking piece, you know, I had met some incredible people through networking, including yourself, Mark, you know, who's become, you know, a mate, a mentor, someone I look up to for guidance. You know, I had met another guy, Adrian Hondros, you know, CEO of Porter Davis Homes, ex-head of CommBank Private. You know, I met all of these people that were really successful in their own right. And it was the first time where, and I said this the other day, I had a presentation for QUT University, and I shared this story with them. It was the first time where I believed in myself to a degree, but when I met people like you, Mark, and I met people like Hondo, they believed in me to a point and saw things in me that I didn't necessarily see in myself that allowed me to kind of get to the next level of success, the next level of belief, the next level that if I wanted to go after something, I was capable in it. So the opportunity at Cub was an opportunity where I was like, hold on a second, the job's not necessarily what I want to be doing. However, connecting and building relationships with other accomplished business owners and entrepreneurs is exactly what I want to be doing. So I did the role for effectively a year, really enjoy it, met some really good people through the back of it. You know, had some huge success within a short period of time. I think within 2 months' time, I was hitting the same numbers as the rest of the team. And so I was like, hold on a second, I've got this gift, which is the ability to sell. I've got this really strong network. But for one thing or another, there's still this friction with me wanting to do my own thing. And so I thought to myself, hold on a second, like if this is me, you know, and the third thing I identified was there was a lot of people joining the community that didn't have the right skills. And the right skills, coming back to the start of our conversation, which you mentioned, which they don't teach at school, they don't teach at university, is the ability to communicate, to persuade, to move someone closer to your idea of thinking. And I saw all of these, you know, a lot of them incredible, accomplished business owners within the room. And I thought to myself, hold on a second, like you're successful in your own right because you have a great product or great service. However, you're probably limited to some degree in terms of your success by one, not having the right ability to sell. And I saw it time and time again in the room. People were very transactional in terms of the way that they sold. People were very one-dimensional in terms of the way that they built relationships. And I thought there is always going to be, unfortunately, a glass ceiling unless one, you have the right support. Two, you have a sales system. And three, you have a more diversified network, because with the community that I was involved in, geographically, you had to be based in Melbourne or Sydney. I was like, the way that the market is working these days is, especially with the pandemic, it doesn't matter where your network is. They could be in Sydney, they could be in Melbourne, they could be in New York, they could be in Paris, they could be in Beijing, or one of my members in Japan is the head of L&D for H&M Group. They just simply need to be people that are willing to connect, willing to provide value to other people, and the best in their field, or the aspiring best in their field. I thought, hold on a second, fuck me. There is a huge gap in the market here to provide a product, provide a business that gives business owners the right skills, the ability to influence, the ability to persuade, the ability to move someone closer to their way of thinking, working with human behavior opposed to against it, the ability to have the right network. And the third piece is having the right support, which is what, through a lot of my career, my early life at university, I never felt like I had. So I was like, if I can do this and create this business that offers three of these things, like sales, I'm solving a problem. And in the heart of a global pandemic, everyone needs community, everyone needs support. And more than ever, everyone, regardless of what business you're in, has become a salesperson again, because when the market is tough and there's less opportunities out there, you need to be able to influence and persuade people to move closer to your way of thinking.
And I guess the digital sales community was born.
It was, mate, with your help, of course.
So tell us a bit. Thanks, mate. Tell us a bit about that experience and what that was like. And I know, you know, I guess for the listeners, what's interesting about Hugh's journey is it's still quite fresh. So this is something that was started this year, obviously transitioning from Carbon, an amazing company, which probably gave you a lot of the confidence, being really close to the market to understand that there's this gap. And, you know, obviously making that leap for anybody has its challenges. What was it like to leave the business and then start your own?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I think when I finish up with Carb, you're exactly right. The people that I had met, you know, so many beautiful people within that business, you know, the people that I worked with, Calvin, with Alice, with, you know, the entire team, you know, really, really great people. But the people that I met within the community had became, you know, really good friends. You know, and that's what they were. They were friends. And the thing that I realized is selling is the idea of to, you know, mutually provide value to someone else. And so I felt like I had a group of people, including yourself and including Hondo, that could provide me support, provide me backing, and provide me assurance that even though I'd never run a business beforehand, I had the right skills to be able to help other people. But I remember when I finished up and I called you, I said, this is what I'm thinking of doing. Like, I'm not sure, like, if this is what I should be doing. And we talked through it. The one thing that you provided to me, which is what everyone needs now more than ever, is support. Everyone needs support, and not support from anyone, support from people that have been out there, have done it, have been successful. You know, you've been a BOW Fast starter, like God knows how many times. You have been, you've helped so many businesses grow. So knowing that you had gone out there and you had executed, provided value to other people, gave me assurance that if I was to take the leap of faith and start my own thing, I wasn't doing it blind. I was doing it with someone that had the right skills of building a business, successfully scaling it, selling it off. So for me, that gave me a lot of confidence that what I was doing, one, it was solving a problem. Two, I had the right support from you. And three, I had the right network around me. So that first 3 months of starting the business was wild. Like, oh my God. Like, seriously, from starting the business, I think I was working 7 days a week, 16 days a week, 16 days a week. Like, it was learning how to do PR, marketing, build a website, do all of that stuff yourself was so exhausting. However, for the first time in my life, and you've guided this conversation, it took me back to the excitement that I had when I first discovered the ability to sell out of my locker at school and make money off the back of it, but doing it whilst providing someone else value. I thought to myself, holy shit, I am so exhausted. Like I business was going to be like this. I thought it was going to be, you know, sunshines and rainbows and really easy. And it was so bloody tough in terms of demanding. However, so wildly fulfilling. Like, I got a call today from one of our members, incredible member, just incredible human being, Ali King, who just left me a voicemail message for, went for about 3 minutes, who just shared one of her wins off the back of the digital sales community. I won't share, she just messaged me now actually. I won't share too much about it, but, you know, she had just won a huge deal off the back of one of the strategies that we implemented. One of the other guys, Mitch Clark, is a great, great human being. He looks like he's going to win a huge deal with the NBL off the back of one of the strategies we've implemented. We've had a huge amount of success stories in the space of 3 months. Like, and so for me, the validation doesn't come from anything other than when I hear those success stories from Ali, I hear those success stories from Mitch, I hear, you know, a success story yesterday from John Pearl in terms of him feeling like he has the right support within the community. So to your point, as someone said to me, actually Hondo said to me, I'm 5 minutes into the first quarter, and that is very, it's kind of bittersweet. It's like, oh my God, I feel like I've
humbling
worked the last 10 years. Yeah, very humbling, very humbling. But it's also a good reminder of how much I've achieved in a short period of time through the community, and how much value that I provide to the community. And wishing that suddenly, you know, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I had access to a platform where I had the ability to have support from a community, I had access to the right sales training, and I had access to the right network. You know, I kind of get envious at times in a really positive sense of the community having access to these tools to be able to kind of grow out their network, grow their business. Because 2 years ago, 5 years ago, up until 6 months ago, there was nothing in the marketplace that provided all those three things.
Why do you think that's the case? If this subject of sales, of persuasion, influencing people to your way of thinking is so vital, why is there this glaring, or has been this glaring gap in the market, do you believe?
I would be keen to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I'm wondering if there's a stigma attached to sales.
And I would agree.
Almost that it's beneath a lot of people. Mm. Ironically, the highest earners, you know, anywhere you'll find, probably in the sales departments, they're almost on an island amongst themselves in terms of what they can earn, maybe separate to founders of business, of really successful businesses. But maybe there's a stigma. I think it's because there's a perception that it's hard, because there's maybe a correlation that when you step up to sell, you have to face rejection. I think as human beings, I don't know too many people that enjoy rejection. I get a funny story. In my second business, my first business was a quite successful service station, and that was a really great experience for me for a lot of reasons. But it was also, sometimes your early success can be your future weakness, in that at a service station, you've got thousands of customers coming into your shop every day wanting and needing this essential thing called fuel, and they're willing to buy things in the shop as well if you can merchandise. But effectively, you've got people coming to you. And that first 5 or 6 years in my business career, when I was ready to make the move into my next business, which was a construction company where we had to go outbound, we had to make ourselves known, you have to reach out. This whole concept of selling, you know, starts to rear its ugly head, so to speak, or what you would think, you know, for people who aren't used to it, I should say. And I remember my business partner, he was more, that was more his function, and I was more in the back end. And one day he turned to me and said, "You know, Mark, yeah, I really want you to get involved in the sales. I think you'd be quite good." And I said, "Look, Joseph, I love you, but I'll never sell."
I'll never do that.
I'll do, you know what I can do, and I'll be valuable in a lot of areas, but I'll never do that. And he, to his credit, he was so good with me. He always said, "Okay, cool, that's okay, all right, all good." And he never invalidated that viewpoint, but he always kept coming back to me, encouraging me to do it, because obviously he saw something in me that I didn't see myself. And that would be, it's immensely powerful for both business owners to be able to prospect the business. And interestingly, you know, that's when he almost broke me down a bit in those kind of following months. And I ended up having to crack that nut and having to find my own way, because there was no leading authority at the time. I had to find my own way and get cobbled together a few tools and a few systems. And the irony is once I understood, like your point about once you finally understand some tools, some practical tools that can help, I found the area to be very empowering. And I felt like if you can win at sales, you can win at anything.
100%.
Interestingly, the most coldest of prospects, the people I didn't have a relationship with, to turn them around and then to do business with them, and we were doing multi-million dollar deals in construction, I found that to be one of the most gratifying parts of the business.
And talk me through this, because this is something I'm keen to know as an accomplished business owner in a number of facets, Mark. It sounds like, what was the gentleman's name that you worked with, Joseph?
Joseph.
So what was the catalyst, though, that you suddenly one day was like, hold on a second, like, I actually need to do this, or I need to figure this out. Was there a moment, or was it simply the fact that he'd kind of brought up so many times that, as you said, he kind of worn you down and going, hold on, I should give this a try? Or was there a moment where he went, if I want to get to where I want to be, or we want to be, something has to change? What happened there for you?
I think inherently, as a business owner, you accept that the buck stops with you. You have to take full responsibility for the success of the business. And in those early few months of the business, I didn't quite know the industry, know the business really well, and I was learning a lot. And then once I realized that if we're going to make it big here, we're going to need to get out there and market and sell and, you know, business development, that was the key to growth. So then it was about, well, I'm a business owner. I'll take responsibility for the success of my business. I'll do whatever I have to do to make it succeed, right? Doing it the right way. And that was almost like an integrity thing. It's like I couldn't lie to myself. If I'm not going to be here as an admin person, I'm going to be here at the front driving the business with my business partner, doing the right thing. And that was just a responsibility thing for me. So that's what got me up onto the plate and facing some initial rejection and then, you know, learning from there.
And how many business owners do you think at the moment, you know, in the middle of a pandemic, and you know, I spoke to someone the other day who's runs one of the biggest funds in Australia. She's a managing director there. And she said that this actually might not be the black swan event. Like what COVID was, you know, it's COVID and it was Delta. Well, could it turn to something else? Could it be something else completely different again? With so much uncertainty in the marketplace at the moment, if you're a business owner and you haven't learned the ability to sell beforehand and you're thinking maybe in a month's time things are going to get better, maybe in 2 weeks' time things are going to get better, but you're actively not learning the right skills or applying them, how important is it for business owners at the moment in this current marketplace with so much uncertainty to learn the right skills in terms of how to sell?
I think it's vital. I think it's common sense that, you know, you can either be reactive or proactive. I like to think of sales as taking responsibility, being proactive, getting ahead, and being the cause of results. I like to think of other kind of peripheral, say, marketing activities as being more reactive. You know, like we spend some money, let's wait and see.
Yeah.
And it's not so proactive. And I feel as though, you know, especially for small and medium-sized businesses, that you don't have the time to be reactive. You've got to be proactive. You've got to be on the front foot. And also, you've got to get out there and engage with the market. Because even if you don't get a sale, you're learning. You're in the customer's mind. You're understanding what's important to them. And it's going to just help you for that next prospecting call or that next, you know, networking event. So I honestly feel business owners and entrepreneurs, you have to take responsibility for the success of the business. There's very few businesses that exist on planet Earth that don't require some sort of outbound selling or getting in front, being proactive. And, you know, if you're in the lucky few, like I was with my first business, that wasn't a big part, well, then maybe this conversation is not so relevant for you at the moment. But businesses change, industries evolve, and it's a key essential skill for success, I believe.
Totally agree, mate. Totally agree. Love it. Beautiful.
I'm interested to know, going back on, you know, that experience when you're at uni and even when you're at the recruiter making those cold calls, you know, creating the digital sales community, you could really get a sense for what they're up against. You know, you've got now an accomplished career in sales in those organizations that you mentioned, had outstanding success, but you're on the kind of other side of it. So a lot of the members coming through in the digital sales community may still be fearing that rejection, maybe still be fearing picking up the phone or entering that networking meeting event. You know, what's your advice to them?
Yeah, really good point. And I think it comes back to the learning at school, which was and university. The practical application of something versus the theoretical application of something, or just the theoretical nature. So for me, it was very much around, I'm not going to share, you know, a lot of sales trainers, salespeople out there talk about psychology, 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 psychology. And really anyone that continually talks about psychology without showing people a blueprint or a strategy is never going to get anyone, maybe they're going to get them short-term action, but without a strategy, without a plan, without a proven system, they're not going to get the results. So I think what's happened with the digital sales community, and it's been in the last month or so, where suddenly there's been like a wave of people, even one of the guys yesterday, Patrick Farnham, who messaged me, I share this within the digital sales community. He booked in 15 to 20 calls in the space of, I think, 24 hours. He said it's more calls that he's booked in, more calls that he's booked in since he started his business. So I think what the community is getting, first and foremost, it's not fluff, it's not bullshit, it's proven systems that they can apply. And when they apply the systems and they get results, as you do as an EOS implementer, they get traction. And when you get traction and you get results and you see that it works, then you have belief. Once you have belief, confidence builds competence. And so very much what we're doing within the community is providing the community with the right skills, the right support, and the right network to ensure that once they implement it, they get the success. It's acknowledged by the community. Once it's acknowledged by the community, it makes them feel good. When you feel good and you're surrounded by other people that are achieving success, it's almost inevitable that the results and the things that you achieve are going to be a product of the work, the effort, and the time that you've put in, and you're going to be inevitably successful.
I love it, mate. And where do you see the digital sales community into the future? What's the vision?
So it's interesting. I've created the model very, very much. So it's about paying it forward. The membership is a no-brainer, and it was designed that way. There's no lock-in contracts. You can sign up for a month. You can unsubscribe any time. I think since we've had the business started for only, it's not even 4 months old. It's crazy. I think we've had two people unsubscribe in the space of 4 months. The community is nearly at 100 members. Within that period of time. But for me, it was very much about providing value to the members, paying it forward, connecting the members. And so for me, it's about providing huge amounts of value, creating value to the members. And what I thought was, as of July next year, I would start doing sales training at a higher level with corporate clients. Invariably, off the back of literally having the business running for 3.5 months, I now have 4 corporate clients that I'm working with. So I think the proof has been I provided value, I paid it forward, and suddenly now I'm working with 4 corporate clients to do sales training. So my thinking is to continue to build out the community, to continue to give success to other people within the community. And then July next year will be very much around corporate training with a number of different businesses, either in the community or outside of the community, and really, you know, creating a business, creating a model where people have the right support, the right network to be successful, and just continuing to build that out over the next 12 months, 24 months, 5 years, 10 years, to hopefully be one of the leading, if not the leading, sales training business in Australia, if not globally.
I love that, man. I love the fact that you're thinking long-term, and that evolution makes a lot of sense. And I'm excited to see where the story is going to go.
Thanks, mate. I appreciate it.
It's probably a great time to dive into our final 5 questions. You ready to go for
it? Let's do it. Let's roll.
All right, Hugh. Who was your idol growing up?
Mum. Yeah, mum, absolutely. Workhorse, A-type personality, paying it forward, always providing value to others. Just an absolute beast.
Sounds like an inspirational, inspirational woman.
Yeah, she set the bar very, very high, but I like that.
Awesome, awesome. How do you think your industries will be different 10 years from now?
I think COVID will be the shift that nearly every business owner, if not every business owner, makes sales a priority. And not old school selling techniques in terms of pushing, Gordon Gekko, Wolf of Wall Street selling techniques, but works with human behavior opposed to against human behavior. So I think sales is going to come, is almost going to have this second wind of spotlight. And the reason why I say that is everyone at the moment, whether you're a marketer, whether you're in any small business, you are first and foremost, your responsibility is to help the business grow. So I think sales in its raw form and having the right skills has never become more important. So I think over the next 10 years, there'll be a lot more spotlight on sales. There'll be a lot more people like myself creating businesses to help support business owners and salespeople. So I think there will be kind of a second wave of sales training in the marketplace over the next 10 years.
What didn't you know about running your business at the start of your journey? I know it's not that long ago that you wished you would have known.
It's interesting. Nothing really. Like, and I don't mean that in a naive sense, but I think having people like you around me, Mark, and I generally mean that, people that are real and open and candid, and you know, like some of the things that we did before I even launched the business was I did surveys with people about, you know, what they wanted from an offering. You know, this was something that you suggested, which was an absolute game changer in terms of making sure that I got the business model right. You know, my wife is a business owner, being surrounded by other accomplished business owners. I asked lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of questions. The only thing that I didn't know is how hard I would be working 6 days a week. However, the feeling that I get is wildly fulfilling, and I could never imagine myself doing anything else than working for myself.
It's a good segue into my next question, which is, if you could earn more money and have more time working for someone else, would you still run your own business?
I think once I have achieved the things that I want to achieve, once I have helped enough business owners achieve their potential and be successful, I think in, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years time, I could be involved in a business in another capacity, knowing that I have gone out there and I have done it. I have the list of accomplishments against my name as a business owner, that at some stage it wouldn't be necessarily be about me having to run it. I could work for someone else, but there would need to be a level of autonomy in that. But I think the way that the market's going, people working remotely from home, companies being very, very aware that employees have lots of choices, lots of options. I think company culture is going to have a revival over the next 5-10 years. So would I work for a large corporate? Potentially not. But would I help a business start, scale up, grow, or work with someone like yourself, Mark? Absolutely.
And what does success in business mean to you, Hugh?
Success in business to me ultimately means knowing what you're doing is providing value to other people. There's been so many times in my career when I was younger where I would chase extrinsic reward. And we were talking about that the other day, you and me, with a book that you're reading at the moment. And it was very much about how I looked to others, how I was perceived by others. And the greatest fulfillment for me has been able to, one, provide value to other people and get those phone calls from Ali, to get the praise from the other members in the community saying, hey, this has really helped me. So success for me is helping other people and connecting with that feeling of feeling good by doing that. And also, as my family starts to get older and they're well off and they're successful in their own right, you know, next year, my wife and I, Marlo, are looking at taking our family, and we've already told them, our family, and Marlo's family, and my auntie Twig, and my I call her a sister, Bree, over to Hamilton Island or Hayman Island, take them on a holiday. And so for me, it's very much about getting to a point where I have enough success, I have enough of a network, I have enough money that it provides me enough financial freedom to go out there and continually pay it forward to others, to genuinely help people, to genuinely make a difference to others, and to make everyone's life a little bit more comfortable.
I love that, mate. I love that. Well said. And if our listeners would like to get a hold of you online, what would you recommend is the best way they do that?
Thanks, mate. The best way to get a hold of me would be on LinkedIn, just Hugh Grover on LinkedIn. I'll be putting this on LinkedIn once this goes live and sharing that with my community also. On Instagram, Hugh Grover. And they would be the two main channels. So, yeah, that's what I would recommend.
All right, mate. I think that that's a wrap for us. And I just want to kind of finish by saying, you know, it's been an incredible journey going through your story. And from that, you know, kid that didn't really know his place at school, it was a bit of a foreign kind of system, but had a unique knack for building relationships and offering value, whether it be in the form of Coca-Cola and radios from a locker, right through to, you know, your journey throughout university, where, you know, you basically had to prospect yourself and your name and build that network from a standing start, you know, a bit of a hiatus in your entrepreneurial career, working for those businesses before setting up your own, but being so vital for you, for your own knowledge, for your own, almost your apprenticeship, so that you could really understand and master your craft, which you did at those companies, to now have the, you know, the courage to set up a business, which I always tip my hat to any business owner or any entrepreneur that does that, and do what you've done this year to set up Digital Sales Community, which is an amazing network, a fast growing network of business owners and sales professionals. I think it's funny how those skills that you knew you had all those years, but you just weren't in the right system for them to flourish, have now come to the surface. And it's no surprise to me why you're doing so well.
Thank you, Mark. And the last thing I want to say to the listeners is the advice, the support that you have given me over the last 3 years, you know, ongoingly, has given me the belief in myself when at times I didn't see the things in myself that you saw in me, gave me the belief to go and start this business. And I feel very, very grateful to have met you. So as much as this has been about my journey, it's been very much around the people around me that have supported me, like yourself, to get here. So thank you for your time, mate.
Thanks, you, mate. It's a pleasure to be part of the story. Thanks, mate.
Thanks, mate.